Hello, and welcome to Talking Story. I'm your host, Lynn Hadley, and today we are speaking with storyteller, historian, children's author, editor, and educator, Marianne Monson. She is currently teaching writing at Clatsop Community College and has taught English and creative writing at Portland Community College and BYU in Hawaii. Marianne has written and published 10 books from children's fiction to adult nonfiction. Thank you for joining us today, Marianne.
Thanks so much, Lynn. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, let's start with how have you always been a writer? Was that something you started at a young age?
Yes, a very young age. Yeah, luckily, I have always been an avid journalist, and I like to hold on to things. So I have the earliest books that I wrote, stapling pages together, you know, like little craft projects from when I was about five.
Do and, it yourself before DIY yeah. was even happening.
Yeah, I was way ahead of that curve. Yep. So I think I was about seven when I wrote in my journal that when I grew up, I wanted to tell stories. And that came from my really profound love of reading. And so, yes, it's always been exactly what I wanted to do. I didn't really have a backup plan.
All right. Mm-hmm. And it's working well. So what inspires your children's books, since that's when what it sounds like where you started
yeah.
your love of reading and writing?
Yes, that's true. I was really obsessed with Anne of Green Gables when I was a kid, so I've always had a deep love for children's literature. And even though I always wanted to be a writer, I think like many writers, I was pretty intimidated by calling myself that or actually going for it, because I had an English degree, but oddly enough, there's not a lot of job openings for quote-unquote writer that you can find straight out of college. So I started working at a publishing house and really didn't have much time for my own creative work until my kids were born. So I think that's why I really started with children's literature, because it was when my kids were really young, and really my own writing has sort of grown up along with them. So I tended to write books that were around the same, intended for around the same age as my children were.
Well, and I understand not only are they inspirational to the children's book writing, but they play a role in as protagonists in the children's literature, or at least
yeah,
one
do.
Of the series.
Yeah, yeah, in the chapter book series called The Enchanted Tunnels. It was directly inspired by a game I used to play with my kids, and so I came up with this series idea and pitched it to a publisher, and they picked it up. So my kids went through this stage when they were around 7 and 8 where they kind of carried the books around because they were really excited that they were characters in the book.
All right. Instead of rock stars, they were book stars.
That's right. Exactly.
Very good.
Which in our family was way cooler. So.
All right. Did they participate in the creation of the books at all, aside from being characters in there?
Well, I mean, I would ask them, they read the dialogue. I remember having them read the dialogue to tell me, you know, does this sound like something you would say? You know, they were great. I mean, if you're writing children's lit and you have children around, it's fantastic. Because you can see their reactions, and children's humor is just really different from adults, you know, and I think we forget. I also remember when we got the illustrations back from the artist who did the illustrations for those books, my daughter was like, I do not look like that. And I had to explain, you know, this is the artist's interpretation. Like, he's not actually trying to draw you. He's Aww. Trying to draw this character.
So. How will my public be able to appreciate me fully?
Right. Exactly.
Wow. Oh, well, and now from children's literature, you've written more recently Frontier Grit, The mm-hmm. Unlikely True Stories of Pioneer Women. Mm-hmm. And in 2018, award-winning Women of the Blue and Gray, Mothers, Medics, Soldiers, and Spies of the Civil War. And mm-hmm. you Tell us, you just won an award for that. That's really exciting.
Yeah, I actually just opened the envelope 10 minutes before I came over to the studio. So it's very fresh. It was exciting. So yeah, it was the Forward Indies Award. And for Forward Reviews, they do an annual book award. So it was in the war and military category. And I was excited to be the only female nominated in that category, the only female author. So
that is wonderful. And winning.
Yeah.
So can you talk more about how you find these women, you know, buried back in the pages of history because they didn't get the attention?
Yeah. So my entry into history was through literature. So I've always loved historical fiction, and that was what I always wanted to write. That was kind of what I set out to write. So I did two historical fiction novels centered in the pioneer time period. It's an era that's always been really fascinating to me, the frontier era. And so then my editor, Heidi Taylor, at Shadow Mountain Publishing, she and I have worked really collaboratively. So she's the one that picked up that children's book series, actually. And then she published the historical novels. And so it was really her idea to transition into more of a creative nonfiction. And she said, what do you think about the idea of doing a nonfiction book that is about female pioneers? And I tossed around the idea. I love the era. I'd done a lot of research on it. I didn't really consider myself a nonfiction writer. And I just wanted to make sure that we weren't kind of rehashing the same old stories about pioneers. Like, I wanted to think, if I was going to do the project, I wanted to make sure that I had something kind of new to say or to bring to the subject. So I came back to her and I said, well, what about if we define pioneer differently? What about if we define it as a woman who traveled beyond the confines of her own people's boundaries and locations, so that we're not limiting it to the westward expansion era and that whole movement, and we can look at women who traveled a number of different directions. So you could have like Mexican American women who traveled north, and you could have Native American women who were removed forcibly from their communities. So just people who, women who participated in some sort of overland journey, but it could have been a variety of different directions, if you will. And Heidi was really excited about that. She totally went for it. So that was what we did. That was really how that book came about. And so what I was looking for was women who had participated in traveling outside their own culture to some extent, in some sort of overland journey, if you will. And then women who didn't have a lot of name recognition. So, you know, like not Sacagawea, like not the people you would know, the handful of women from that era who do have name recognition. I wanted to avoid them. There's been lots written about them, you know, so I wanted to find stories. And then also women who had done remarkable things, so that they had been pioneers on more than one level, if that makes sense. So that was really what I looked for. And so I was like, used that criteria and found 12 different women that I was really excited about to kind of dive into their stories and to research. And so that was how those 12 women were chosen. There was like really no connection other than that, other than they had those handful of things in common.
And I'm sure your journalism background came in handy for the research as far as diving into.
Yeah.
I know that there are the kind of go-to sources or library archives and letters and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But have you gotten pretty creative? I think you must have. When I'm thinking of Aunt Clara Brown from Frontier Grit.
Yeah.
She was, from my understanding, not terribly literate.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah,
it would have, you would have had to get pretty creative to come across accounts of what she was doing and going through.
Yeah. And I think that's actually where my background in creative writing kind of serves me well, because I tend to think a little bit outside the box, I guess, in approaching it. That's really the story of all of women's history, though, is being creative, getting creative, and reading between the lines. I think, I guess, maybe my hero in that regard is Laurel Thatcher Ulrich. I don't know if you know her work, but she's a a female historian at Harvard University, and she just does such amazing work to piece together the picture behind the few fragments that we have, you know, and to kind of contextualize it and figure out what it means, because it tends to be really scant records that we're dealing with. And so it takes a bit of massaging, if you will, and looking at it with the historical context and trying to figure out what it meant within that woman's life. For Claire Brown, we do have quite a few newspaper clippings about her, because she became fairly famous because she became one of the wealthiest women in the West, which is really amazing. Her story out of slavery is just incredible. But she, you know, she came west and then amassed a fortune in Colorado in the frontier as a laundry woman. And
a laundry heiress.
Yes, a laundry heiress. And then she invested in some of the local mines and they paid off. And then she used her fortune to basically help fund the resettlement of former slaves coming out of the South post-Civil War. So her story is a remarkable one. But yeah, she wasn't literate. So we don't have, you know, journals. We don't have letters. But we do have a lot of newspapers that wrote about her, you know, luckily. And then a handful of primary sources. So...
Wonderful. Mm-hmm. I've always been fascinated by the women in history who refused to, you know, stay back and uh-huh. out of the action of what was going on.
Yeah.
And, you know, participated by any means.
Uh-huh.
And the Civil War obviously was a terrible time. The women you highlight in the women blue and gray
mm-hmm.
Went to great effort. Mm-hmm. And put themselves at tremendous peril
mm-hmm.
to participate in what lengths did they go to be involved? If you can recount that in a short telling.
Yeah. I mean, that's a really multifaceted question, because it was so different for the women themselves, you know, and a lot of it depended if they were in the North or if they were in the South or if they were enslaved or if they were Native American. You know, I really try and touch on a multitude of women's experiences during the Civil War in the book, but they were involved in so many ways that I never heard about in history class. You know, I think luckily some of these accounts that have emerged from women historians are starting to be incorporated into the dominant narrative around history, which is really exciting. But so much, especially of military history, tends to be very white male dominated, you know, and we hear very few stories about what women, especially women of color, were doing, you know, but they actually contributed to the Civil War in a number of ways. And hundreds of them dressed up as men took on adopted male identities and fought on the battlefields of the Civil War. Everything from Gettysburg, you know, to many of the other major battles. So they were, and they did that for a lot of different reasons. Some of them wanted to go with family members, you know, either husbands or fathers or brothers. They enlisted, and the thought of being separated from that loved one for years with such scanty contact options, you know, and not knowing they'd ever see them again, it led them to be motivated to go with them. But it was a lot more complicated than that too, because many of them didn't go with family members. Some of them just wanted the adventure. Some of them found that they really liked soldiering. And for many of them, it was a very dependable job and that they couldn't have as a female. So it was like a guaranteed meal and income that they couldn't easily have in another way, as well as a good opportunity to adventure and see the country. So, yeah, there were a lot of a wide variety of reasons that drew them there. But beyond the soldiers, women participated as spies. They were really well suited to espionage work because in the Victorian era, notions about their gender, they were seen, especially at the outset of the war, as sort of beyond suspicion. So, and they used that very well to their advantage, you know, batted their eyelashes and said, I couldn't possibly. And
why would I have guns under my petticoat?
Exactly. And they were really creative with the work they did. I mean, they would take, you know, battle plans and hide them in their huge hairdos. They're very elaborate hairdos. Or they would smuggle armaments beneath their petticoats and in their bodices. You know, they had to wear so many clothes. So, so they took full advantage of that. And then some women who had backgrounds in acting really loved the espionage work because they would basically dress up as a wide variety of characters and use that to kind of
every day infiltrate. Was showtime.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, they participated in a really wide variety of ways that, to me anyway, I hadn't heard. I felt like it was way beyond the dominant narrative of what I knew about the Civil War. So. It was just really exciting and fascinating roles that they played and really contributed to the I hadn't realized the extent of their organization either. The way that they helped directly fundraise for the war, they mobilized what would become the Red Cross. You know, Clara Barton started the Red Cross post-Civil War, but she was doing the work of basically organizing all of these supplies, providing battle relief, you know, right as soon as the battles were finished. Clara was there, and many other nurses were right on the battlefield as well, providing emergency relief to those who fell.
Well, I hope to continue talking. I just want to remind everyone they're tuned to Coast Community Radio. This is Talking Story with your host, Lynn Hadley, and we are speaking with, storyteller, historian, journalist, educator extraordinaire, Marianne Monson.
Thank you.
And yes, I would like for you to elaborate on what I know of the medical scene during the Civil War. It was intensely gruesome.
Yeah, it was very gruesome, especially in the South. So in the Confederate hospitals, they didn't have adequate, and particularly in the prisons for the prisoners of war in the South too. So, you know, the Confederacy at the end didn't have adequate medical supplies for their own soldiers, much less any Union soldiers who were captured. So yeah, it was pretty horrific. That's where you get most of the stories of the conducting amputation without medicine and that kind of thing, without chloroform. But in the North, that was much less common, so but not unheard of. So.
Well, perhaps we could talk about something a little more sterile.
Sure.
Yeah, I know you teach quite a bit.
Yeah.
And does teaching offer an opportunity to assist these kind of heroes of the future to access and find their stories?
Yeah, that's exactly that. I think that's a great way to put it. It's I really enjoy working with students at Clatsop Community College. You know, it's a really different environment than the one I grew up in. I grew up in Chicago, so it's a much bigger city, but it's a really lovely community here in Astoria, and I really enjoy being part of the college and inspiring students, particularly ones who want to write. But I like to think I inspire the ones who don't like writing either, so make them think that it's a little bit more enjoyable than they'd previously thought.
I say this program is based on the premise that everyone is carrying a jewel box of stories from their life experiences. Mm. Are you hoping to share those tools to bring these jewels to light, so to speak, in education?
Yeah, I really like that premise of your show. I think that's true. And I think especially in my writing workshops that I do, through the Writers Guild and at Sou'wester, different opportunities. I always try and encourage people to tell their stories. I think sometimes we approach writing with an attitude that to really enjoy it, you have to publish. And that's such a detrimental attitude. We don't really have that idea about any of the other arts. You know, if you just decide you want to take piano lessons, nobody's going to ask you if you want to, you know, become a professional pianist.
Right.
You know? It's you doing it for fun. But somehow, the minute somebody says they like writing, the next question is, like, are you going to publish it? You know? So I think that writing is something that I try and encourage people to enjoy regardless of what their goal is. You know, if they just want to be a journalist, if they just want to write stories for their own selves. But, like, certainly with the historical research I've done, I think it's true that everyone does have their own story, and it's so valuable, incredibly valuable, to write it down in some form. And it doesn't have to be anything as daunting as, like, a life history, you know, at all.
When I was in fourth grade, we went on a field trip.
Right. That sounds really overwhelming and, I don't know, frankly, a little boring and tedious, really. And so I think the first rule with writing is that there are no rules, and you should write what sounds really fun to you to write about, because that's where you'll always do your best work. So just leaving something behind. You know, I have a small collection of poems that were written by my great-grandmother, who I never met, obviously. And she lived in Idaho. And I had no idea till I read these poems a few years ago that she had visited Oregon. And she wrote poetry about how beautiful Oregon was and compared it to the Garden of Eden. And it was just, it reminded me so much of how I felt the first time I came to Oregon. And it was such an amazing connection to share that with her, you know, across all of those years. Those poems are so precious to me. So just write something. Your kids will be appreciative.
Exactly.
And if they're not, your grandkids will.
Well, that's a wonderful statement to just put it down, mm-hmm. You know,
yeah.
And share.
Yes. Yep.
And I understand your next project is a fictionalized account, mm-hmm. of one of the pioneer women from Frontier Grit.
Yes.
Martha Hughes Cannon.
That's right.
You must have gotten to know her very well in the research. She was a very accomplished female doctor and first woman state senator.
Yep.
And I'm also kind of amazed because I believe at her request, several of her personal documents were destroyed at her death.
All of her personal journals, yeah. Unfortunately. It's so sad. That's the other rule. Don't ever destroy what you write. So, yeah, unfortunately, she did. And also, unfortunately, her son complied with her request. So the main sources that we have for Martha are letters that she wrote to her husband, and then we have his responses, and then letters she also wrote to her mother and to her best friend. So that's really the bulk of the primary source material that we have for her life. So I'm drawing really heavily on those letters in the novel. But yeah, I would give anything to read those journals that she burned.
Yes.
Yeah.
But it also, does it offer you a bit of a freedom in fictionalizing,
yes, well,
the account
I hadn't
of her
about
life?
That, but I suppose it does. Yeah. Yeah. She was born in Llandudno, Wales. And I just got back from researching over there, actually.
Oh, so wonderful.
I had the Yeah, thanks to a grant from Clatsop Community College, actually, a faculty grant. So, yeah, I just returned from doing research there, which was wonderful. And she's someone who really hasn't had a lot of name recognition. But next year, 2020, is the 100th anniversary of U.S. women's suffrage, of the 19th Amendment being passed. So that's really the impetus for this novel. It's coming out in conjunction with that celebration. And there's a statue of Martha going to Washington, D.C. And there's also going to be a monument that is being designed right now in Llandudno, Wales. It's going to be unveiled next year as well. So,
well, I hope
you're
going to
hear
her
name more often. I hope so too.
That's wonderful.
Thank you.
Oh, my goodness. So we've gone from children's fiction, nonfiction, and you've we didn't talk about it, but you had a collaboration with the Oregon Poet Laureate Kim Stafford.
Oh yeah, that's in my role with the Astoria Writers Guild. It's the literary nonprofit that I started a year ago, a little bit more than a year ago. So yeah, we worked with Forest Visions. It's another local. They're not a nonprofit, but they're a project that is kind of bringing awareness to the forest. And so they brought Kim Stafford out, and we helped coordinate his visits to the school, the Writers Guild did. And it was wonderful. I think it was so amazing. Anyone who's worked with Kim Stafford can imagine what that or was there. A lot of Astorians came out to the various events that we had while he was here. So it was one. He was here for Earth Day. So
oh,
yeah.
Wonderful.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And the other Writers Guild projects, one includes a collaboration with the AVA, the Astoria mm-hmm. Visual Arts.
Yeah.
Do you want to talk about that program?
Yes. So the Writers Guild with AVA collaborated on sponsoring a writer in residence program for this summer. And so we basically requested applications for people who wanted to spend a week in a cottage up on Wallapa Bay writing. Honestly, I really wanted to apply under a false name, but I didn't. So in the end, Lisa Smith, who's president of AVA, and I, we couldn't just choose one, so we ended up choosing two. We narrowed it down. The board of the guild narrowed it down, and then she made the final selection. So she chose Cecilia Hagen, who is going to be doing a reception and reading this coming Wednesday. And then Andrew Zing, who is going to be doing his reception and reading on August 2nd. And that's 6 to 8 at the AVA Gallery Space in Astoria.
So, wonderful.
Yeah. So they get to spend a week up in the cottage just writing idyllically.
Yes. Yeah. Well, how fortunate for them.
I know.
And how nice that you're providing that space for them.
It was mostly Lisa. It's her cottage. But it was great to be involved. And we so admire the work that AVA has done in the community. So, yeah, actually, they were really my motivation in starting the guild as I moved to Astoria, saw what AVA was doing, and was really jealous because I wanted the same thing for writers. So I'm working on following in their footsteps.
Wow. So you have a big role in the Astoria Writers Guild.
Well, I'm the president. Yeah, I'm
That's
the
a
founder
big
and
role.
President. Yeah. Yeah.
Wow. Well, what a wonderful thing to offer our community.
It's been really fun. This community loves their arts and they love their books. So it's a pretty heavenly place to be as a writer.
Well, do you have some more things on the horizon, or would you like to add anything more about your journey in writing and teaching?
Oh, that's so hard to sum up. I'm so grateful that I get to do the work I do. Like every day I wake up and I just kind of have to pinch myself, but I get to do that work. You know, it's really a privilege to work with words, to work with stories, to work with other storytellers. So.
Well, wonderful. And, yeah. And I feel privileged to have spoken with you today, Marianne.
Thank you.
We've been talking with Marianne Munson, author, educator, and historian. So many different things that we've just started to touch on the surface of here on Talking Story. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much, Lynn. It was a pleasure.